The purpose of Retire with Style is to help you discover the retirement income plan that is right for you. The first step is to discover your retirement income personality. Start by going to risaprofile.com/style and sign up to take the industry's first financial personality tool for retirement planning. Changes in platitudes, changes in attitudes. Nothing remains quite the same. Or does it?
Hey, everyone. Welcome to another exciting episode of Retire with Style. I'm Wade.
And I'm Alex.
And this week, we're going to be continuing the conversation that we started with the last episode about this idea of we are now in a downturn in financial. And that can cause a lot of havoc and concern. And what we talked about in the last episode with Bob French as our guest was just what's happening in the financial markets right now and how to think about that more from the purely rational, assuming people know exactly what they need to do in terms of rational thinking. But there's an important behavioral aspect to that. And that's an area that Alex really has his focus on, this idea of behavioral finance, of the emotions of, even though you may know in a coldly rational sense you should respond to a market downturn, the psychological makeup we have as investors doesn't always translate into being able to coordinate well with this coldly rational calculation that we may be doing with the other part of our brain. So Alex, we really want to have this opportunity in this episode to consider some of these kind of behavioral quirks that exist and how people can put into the context their own planning, how to manage and overcome these types of quirks so that they can, as best as possible, stick with the strategy or stick with the plan that they have and as the best approach ultimately in the long run, manage this kind of market volatility environment. So what should investors be thinking about in terms of behavioral biases when it comes to dealing with market downturns and financial market declines? Are we as humans evolved to handle this sort of thing?
Well, results vary would be my initial answer, Wade, with regards to everyone. But you bring up a good point at the very beginning, and that was the last week's episode. We spoke about, look, this is what descriptively is happening with the markets, and the end result is, effectively, this is what you've signed up for if you wanted to participate in these market returns. The reality is that's very easy for us to say, and it's one of these things that's difficult for us to implement. And we're being a little too cute by half by leaving it at that. And so the realization is, let's really try to dig into the importance of discipline. And at this stage, if this is a topic that's of interest, everyone has, to some extent, been exposed to behavior of finance and the terms like loss aversion. It seems these are kind of Jeopardy questions at this point. But what's interesting now is that the emotional tenor of what's happening is heightened simply because of the extreme volatility that you've had, and largely on the downside, even though you get respites here and there, it's largely been on the downside. And so there's just this greater association right now with these terms and the ability to recognize them with yourself. And so let's review some of these main concepts of why, to some extent, we tend to be maladaptive investors. Now, a little quirk is the idea here, because we did this in the last episode, we don't believe you can forecast. And it's one of these things that it's tough because you listen to these podcasts about the market downturn and ultimately somebody wants to hear, well, what should I do next? What should I do next? But that what should I do next question is based on some forecasting. Or, to some extent, there's this platitude of just nothing and sit back. And while one of those may be more truthful than the other, the way it's delivered is kind of insensitive, maybe too strong of a word, but I think it runs that danger. And I think it's important not to point out that you don't necessarily need to figure out what's going to happen next to be successful. I would frame it in terms of think about what the next best step is within the process and implement that. Because if you're running with a good process, then ultimately you're giving yourself the best chance for success. But again, these are one of these things that's easier to say. Why is this comment difficult to implement? Why is this important? Well, ultimately, I said earlier, we're simply not wired for investing. We're not. And to take a step back, even go on, wait.
I think that's like a really important starting point. I've always kind of been interested in this like evolutionary argument of like early humans saw danger. What were they doing in response? It wasn't necessarily staying the course, not panicking, not doing anything. But that's ultimately like a short-term danger. The human response is like the fight or flight mechanism. You kind of get stressed. You run away if necessary. And that doesn't necessarily work with financial markets, which is a relatively recent development in human evolution. So if you want to comment a bit more on that kind of evolutionary concept.
100%. I don't know the exact numbers, right? But I think we've been around something like 300,000 years in rough numbers. And depending on who you ask, right, how long have the markets been around, Wade? You have a better sense of that than I do. What would you say?
So, I don't know how you exactly define a market, but like modern style stock markets and things, we're really just maybe the past 500 years.
Maybe
some societies that had something going for
maybe the
back,
Dutch were innovators.
Relatively recent.
yeah. But for the most part, you're looking at 300,000 years of evolution versus, let's just say, for argument's sake, because 100 years now, doesn't really matter when you're comparing it to 300,000. Let's just say 500 to be safe, right? 300,000 years of, getting beaten over the head with lions in the savannah versus 500 years, I think you're 100% right. We're wired ultimately to be very, very cautious. It's not like if you hear a noise in the shrubs of the savannah, you're going to run a risk-reward analysis and the like. You're just going to run and ask questions later.
Mm-hmm. And that's where when you see a downturn in the financial markets, is it's triggering that same sort of like response in our minds where what we're used to doing evolutionarily speaking is run away and panicking. And then what that translates into abandoning our strategy. And that's not necessarily the way to get the best long-term gains out of a financial market investing-based approach.
Exactly. And so these are one of these things, and we're pointing this out not necessarily to point fingers at anyone at all. Wade and I go through the same slings and arrows that you do with regards to this. I'm just pointing out that it's difficult for us to fight 300,000 years of how we're wired versus, the baby in the E-Trade commercials. It's just one of these things that it's not an equal weighted set of valences here.
Right, and there's also, for me, it's definitely stressful whenever the markets go down. And we recently saw like a 3% or more downturn in one day, which just adds to the further compounding of what's been happening. And it's hard not to feel stress about that. But I'm still far enough away from retirement myself that I can frame that more just at a personal level as a buying opportunity. Though I recognize if I were closer to retirement and I didn't necessarily anticipate having future savings to make purchasings at a discount in the financial markets, I might not be able to have that same sort of response. And as people are getting closer to the retirement date in that red zone around retirement or that risk zone, it can be a lot more stressful than it is for people who may still be 15, 20, 20 plus from retiring.
Exactly. And the other caveat I would add to this, and it's because this is the Retire with Style podcast, not the Investing for Accumulation podcast, is that there are many strategies with regards to retirement income. And so there are strategies in which you can immunize yourself to some extent from needing to be tethered to the stock market success to have a successful retirement income plan. But we have plenty of previous episodes where we review it over and over and over and over. So I'll leave it there.
Right. This is going to be the biggest issue for those with the total return strategy, that the assumptions behind that strategy tell you, well, it's supposedly your preference is you are comfortable relying to perform over the long term. And to have that comfort, you do have to weather that short-term market volatility. So if that resonates with you, great. But then this is the time where that's really put to the... If that doesn't resonate with you, indeed, there are other retirement styles available that don't require being tethered to the market, at least for the basic retirement spending needs.
Now, if you're in accumulation, it is what it is. Now, that being the case, there's that... We're hesitant humans to a large extent. The other sort of generalized statement that I feel comfortable making is that from an evolutionary standpoint, our brains need to be efficient. Our brains take up a significant amount of caloric intake. And, the real 2-20 rule is effectively your body, the brain is 2% of your body, but for weight, it's 5%. Your brain is 2% of your body weight, but it uses 20% of the energy. So think about how taxing the brain is. And so for us to have, evolved effectively, we have needed to take mental shortcuts. You can't process every single decision that you make. So adaptively, the brain has started, has been wired to take these mental shortcuts, these heuristics. I think when you look at the data, and I'm doing this, don't quote me on this, if you will, but it's something like over 30,000 decisions a day. That's about one every 2 to 3 seconds. You're literally making one decision every 2 to 3 seconds that you don't really even realize. And that's simply because you can't. If you were in going back to that savanna thing, if you heard noise in the brush coupled with this hesitancy, you're not gonna run all of a sudden the equivalent of a portfolio optimization strategy to see what's the best angle, what's the best direction to run relative to the distance and wind pressure and the like. It just doesn't work like that. Wade?
Yeah, when danger lurks, you don't have the time to run the pros and cons and make a fully rational decision there. You need some sort of mental shortcut. And that,
yeah,
and it's mental shortcut is the danger as quickly as possible.
Yeah, and it's not just the danger piece. It's also the everyday decisions. How am I going to put on this shirt? You don't literally tell yourself anymore, okay, the left hand goes here, the right hand goes there. A quick thing is, for men out there, shave with your opposite hand and see how jarring it is on day one. It's just one of these things, right? You don't even think about it anymore. Except for Wade, who's been sporting a beard lately. Right, Wade?
Yeah, then I don't have to worry about shaving.
Yeah. So we got this sort of flight or fight. If we weren't flighting, we may not have been around, frankly, relative to our rivalries that we had back then. There's this we need to have these mental shortcuts, these heuristics for our brain for us to function. If not, we'd be paralyzed in analysis all the time. And mental shortcuts will ultimately lead to biases, which we'll cover in a bit. And the last sort of triumvirate of these things, in our view, is that we're social beings. We're social beings. And Wade, do you want to talk about that one a little bit?
I'd be happy to. And I'm kind of looking at some notes you put together, but I wasn't entirely sure what angle you were going with. Let us know. How does being a social being impact?
Well, this goes back to... You read this a lot in these behavioral finance books and the like, is that, look, we're social beings, and a part of our large success is just this ability for our gregariousness, this community building. The story is, if you put one person in an island versus one monkey and you come back a year later, the monkey's probably alive and we're not. You put 100 monkeys and 100 humans in that island, it's a different story. To a large extent. And so there's this need for us to work in harmony together for the survival of the species. And it's helped us be adaptive. And so when you think about markets, when you have these upswings and downswings, you kind of look at what's around, what's going on, right? You don't want to be, if you're not the fastest gazelle, you kind of want to be in that middle of the pack,
yeah, you're
if you will.
Herd.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's where I was getting at with that point. And I think these are important points. So if you just take a step back, forget about what's happening in the Ukraine. It's human tragedies. I don't mean to minimize it in that sense. But from the standpoint of the markets, you know, there's inflation, there's all of these, this wall of worry that you'll always have no matter what. There's always a perpetual wall of worry. But if you think about it, how you react to this, you know, you're externalizing it, but if you can just think about how you react to this with the standpoint of flight or fight, from the standpoint of these heuristics, these proclivities for heuristics that we absolutely need to survive, and then this sort of social being inclination that we have simply for our survival, you're swimming upstream here a little bit. And so this is why we don't want to come across as tone deaf by saying, hey, this is what you signed up for. Enjoy the volatility because this is what gives you future returns. While that's true, it doesn't quite sit well with everyone.
Yeah, fair enough. And I see your point about the social beings, that once someone starts panicking, that can start to cascade. And so then if the media is like, has all these scare stories going on about financial markets, that may be more difficult to overcome that sort of desire to follow the herd and to be able to stay the course with your strategy.
And absolutely. And again, all these things, they're not bad. This is what has made us the apex creature on the planet. These tendencies, they've absolutely contributed to us being the apex creature on the planet. Unfortunately, they kind of go against what you need to be a successful investor. Now, is this something just by listening to this podcast, voila, you've changed? Of course not. Of course not. You know, you've lived so many years of your life, you have that going against you, and you have just the you know, how you've been, how we as a race have evolved. I mean, we've been around for 300,000 years, investing in this manner at best 500 years. And let's just say really 100. You know, it's one of these things that it's just difficult that for us to fight against. And that's it. So how does this manifest itself in these behaviors, if you will? Now, that was just the top level kind of pillars, if you will. But this is where there was a whole science around this with regards to behavior of finance.
Worried about how the markets have impacted your investments and retirement plan? Speak with a financial advisor from McLean Asset Management to make sure that you're positioned correctly. Just go to McLeanAM.com/start to get started. That's McLeanAM.com/start.
Yeah, and I come from the economics world where for most of the 20th century, the idea was people made purely rational decisions, and then behavioral finance comes along and starts to make all these points that human decision-making isn't always purely rational. There's this need to create shortcuts in the decision process, which then can lead to the biases. And so let's start talking about what some of those contributions of behavioral finance are that can help us better understand what we may be dealing with when trying to manage our investment strategies in a period of market volatility.
Sure. Well, to quote Keith Jackson from his Rose Bowl days, the granddaddy of them all is loss aversion, really, when it comes down to it. Remember our preference for having an abundance of caution that we spoke about earlier out in the savannas? Well, the reality is you have loss aversion. This is something that it's just this baseline where the pain of a loss is greater than the joy of a gain. And that's simply put, it was adaptive. And creatures that exhibited this, humans that exhibited this, were able to carry on more than others because they would have been killed by some attacking creature in the bush, if you will. So it's one of these things that's just promulgated itself. And it's good from an adaptive standpoint, but from an investing standpoint, you can see how if you just experience this 20% decline as of this recording, you know, from officially a bear market kind of sense, well, it's one of those that you're fighting upstream against this feeling that you're feeling right now.
Yeah, I think like maybe a point there is, so once the downturn at the start of the pandemic got over, the rest of 2020 was a really good year for markets. 2021 was a really good year for markets. We're now down 15 to 20%, somewhere in that ballpark right now for the year to date. And that with loss aversion, we frame that as, oh, 15 to 20% of my wealth, that can make me feel terrible. But if we could instead frame, and maybe your brokerage accounts will show this, you may still have overall gains in your account. And so if you could frame instead of, well, I still have money, I just lost relative to the high watermark that I was at, that maybe can make you feel better. That's at least, I think, internally, think about it as well. I don't focus so much on how much I've lost relative to the highest account, the value that I ever had, but rather the fact that I'm still ahead overall, and maybe I can sleep better at night that way.
I think that makes great sense, Wade. That's a great framing exercise. The other piece here is that a reason maybe that's not being done is due to another bias, which is recency effect, right? And what that implies is you take what's happening now and you extrapolate that into the future. You just assume, okay, this is what's going to happen from now on. And so there's less, if you really succumb to that, there's less of this desire to do what you said, Wade, which is, hey, but I'm still up. You know, this kind of house is money kind of tendency here. Here, they're assuming, well, you know what? It's a new thing. Based on what's happening right now, inflation is going to be crazy for the next cycle or two or three or four. And, you know, it's easy to then think, okay, well, at the start of 82, was this sort of generational cyclicality towards lowering rates. And obviously it bottomed out, you know, maybe sometime last year. And now we're back on the upswing, you know, for effectively another generational cycle. I'm making this up, frankly. But this is what you start thinking about when you think about this recency effect. Is this right there where you start thinking, okay, well, inflation is here. You know what? If inflation goes back up to 12% or 18% when 1982 rates, I got to get out. And all of a sudden you start assuming what you're assuming are facts, and you run into trouble. And that's what the recency effect is. When you just extrapolate what's happening now and you just assume to be factual is going to happen into the future, you run into problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of how people tend to think about financial markets. What goes up will continue to go up, and what starts going down will continue to go down, when the reality is there's a lot more nuance to that. And what goes up may become a random walk, continue to go up, it may level off, it may go down. It's not just that the recent past couple months of what's been happening in financial markets reflects the long-term potential. I think when we were talking with Bob before, he was provided a number of examples from the historical data where at some point within a calendar year, markets may have been down 10 or 15%, but still ended the year with high gains. Not to say that that will happen this year necessarily, but it just reflects this idea of with recency bias. I think people are overly worried that maybe markets are down 20% and the year 40% down. And of course that could happen, but there's no particular reason to be overly worried that that will happen, that it's the recency bias that leads us to make that sort of extrapolation.
That's a great point, Wade. And you could see how, I'm going to bring up another one, and they're all related, as we also saw in our study. They're not as clearly demarcated as we're making them out to be. There's this general cloud of heuristics, if you will. But you can see how you bring in overconfidence now. There's this overconfidence bias where we assume that you know, we know more than everyone else. It's the Lake Wobegon effect. Everyone's above average driver, etc. And here, if you have this recency effect, you saw what's going on previously, you start to think you're able to properly handicap what's going to happen next. And you begin to, and if you couple that with, I know more than everyone else, remember the main premise is, and Wade said this in the previous episode, listen, the markets aren't perfect. Maybe they're overpriced, maybe they're underpriced, who knows? But they're the best estimate in an aggregate of what the pricing is, right? And so if you have this over, if you have this overconfidence, you're also thinking, you know what, I do think inflation is going up. I'm not extrapolating that into ad infinitum, but you know what? I'm going to be able to tell when to go back in. So I'm going to go out now. I'm going to wait for inflation to do its thing. Once it's settled, I'm going to be able to identify it, and I'm going to come back in and reap those benefits. We get people that do that all the time. I'm not trading in and out every day, but I'm going to count the cycles and figure this out. And that I think Sharpe did a paper, Willem Sharpe, and it was something like, you have to be right in the low 80s, I don't know, 81, 82% of the time to be able to beat the market on these kind of tactical bets. It just doesn't happen. You may have gotten it once, and if you got it once, I would say usually congratulations, but that's probably the worst thing that happened to you, because all of a sudden, you know, the Nobel awaits, right? You think you figured it out, and it's just a matter of time at that point. It's like you're in the casino, you put your money on 8, you got it. You put your money on 8 again, you got it. You know, the casino's not worried. The casino's not worried. They know everything it's going to average out. Wade, you're going to say something?
Right, and that's where sometimes people pressure, because like there's millions of investors, and if you just think of calling a coin flip heads or tails, when you have millions of people doing that, some small percentage of them will be able to correctly predict heads or tails 10 times in a row. And then we suddenly think, oh, these people know what they're doing. But then it's all, every time they make that prediction, it's still just a 50% chance of being right. And that's where ultimately the luck aspect of it may catch up to make that realization that it wasn't necessarily skill. And there's another cousin of this overconfidence bias, which is just people also have a tendency when we look back at historical actions, after the fact, it seems like, oh, that was completely predictable. I understand why that particular event happened. And therefore, because of that, I can now be more confident about forecasting or predicting when such things would take place in the future as well, which may lead to that greater issue of overconfidence.
No, absolutely. You know where I thought you were going to go with this, Wade? I thought you were going to talk about baseline rates and gambler's fallacy, which is because we were talking about, you know, getting in, getting out. This is where, so think about this, right? How the cards are stacked against you. And by you, I mean myself as well, and I mean Wade as well, right? Even Bob, because we like to kick Bob around. But if you really think about this, there's a loss aversion tendency. There's this recency tendency. There's this overconfidence tendency. But we also have, you throw in gambler's fallacy, which is this idea that you think you're detecting patterns where none really exist. And this happens all the time where you start thinking, okay, it's gone down on three. The market's gone down 3 days in a row. We're going up on a Friday, you know what? And then over the weekend, there's going to be information. It's going to continue to go down because it's gone down over the last three Fridays over the weekend because whatever. And this happened in the pandemic. You know, new news would come out over the weekend. And so, you know what? The idea was no traders were holding their positions over the weekend. You know, some silliness like that. And think about all the previous biases. You throw in this idea that you think you can spot patterns when none really exist. It's just a recipe for complete disaster.
Mm-hmm. Now another aspect that we did touch upon already was this idea of the herd mentality, but then that can further contribute to, like, if everyone's kind of following what everyone else is doing, you can get into these boom and bust cycles of fear or greed, where when the market is going up, and coupled with these other biases, the recency bias and so forth, the following the herd, everyone's really piling into the market. And in the short run, that can in the short run help it to continue to go up. But then at some point, some sort of fear sets in, and that can reverse the direction. And everyone starts to panic and abandon the market. And so then it can overshoot in the other direction. And over time, it might have some sort of long-term reasonable growth rate. But there's a lot of volatility in the short term that some of these behavioral explanations about financial market volatility really focus on. It's just people's behaviors can amplify the investment volatility. And so that's another important consideration of understanding these sort of cyclical market dynamics.
Yeah, and
biases too. Uh, Do you want to talk a bit about the endowment effect? I don't think we've
had sure. That we can cover a couple quickly, but I think these were the main ones from the standpoint of, and I will in a second. But what I wanted to say, if you take again, I'll say it because it's worth mentioning, especially in a podcast. You take loss aversion, you take the sense of recency effect, you take this overconfidence bias. You consider, you know, can I really detect? Am I really detecting a pattern, or are these just hunches? Right? You take just those four, if you will, you couple them with what's happening right now. And it's one of these where it's a big caveat emptor. It's one, you know, and we want to do this episode this week because it's very salient. It's one of these things that you could read a book, right? Thinking Fast and Slow or whatnot, a year from now and be like, oh yes, I get it. When things are at their boiling point, I'm going to be able to hold on to this idea and prevail. Well, the reality is these are these moments right now that we're going through, and I think it's just important. Are there other biases? Absolutely. There's, you know, I think scientists have come up, I don't know, they would say 100 or so, but the reality is there's others. There's the endowment effect, which is you kind of like to hold on to something, you value something more if it's yours. Hence, this would be the idea of holding on to losers, stocks that have gone down a little longer than necessary if the investment premise is no longer valid, just because it was yours. There's also affinity traps, where you kind of follow the advice of people that you're familiar with, not even necessarily people you know. It could be just Wade and myself, simply because you've heard us now a handful of times. Just because of that repetition, we, you know, subconsciously or not, our voice, our opinions begin to carry a little more weight than if you've never heard us before. It's one of those things. And this is where I would say caveat emptor with regards to CNBC. Even if you're just watching it for current events, you kind of start hearing these people and you're like, wow, this guy is really onto something after a while. And it's really nothing more than the effect of him being, you know, on a daily basis or her exposed. Now, I'd like to transition, Wade, if we can, on, you know, what helps with this in our view, right? What helps with this? Because I would like to say everyone is sort of guilty of this. They're not guilty. Everyone just has this. And so it's not a thing about intelligence. You can't outthink it. You can't outhuman it because we are who we are from that standpoint. But I do believe if you work within a framework and you put yourself in the right environment, you begin to give yourself a better chance of success. And I said better chance, not a guaranteed chance, because I think that's very important. And working within a framework goes a long way towards doing this. And so, Wade, I think it'd be helpful if you spend a few minutes, not a ton of them, but a few minutes on the underlying framework that we make our retirement income plans around. Because then I could follow up with just how a financial plan helps you implement a framework like this and helps, immunize is too strong a word, but helps kind of reduce the noise, if you will, for you.
Yeah, I mean, just being able to document in writing what you're aiming to do might help you review those notes during. And that's the whole idea behind like an investment policy statement, that you could even have a retirement policy statement that, I know markets will be volatile this act, maybe I'll cut my spending a little bit, but I'll try not to do wild things like abandoning my investment strategy and so forth. But that's, yeah, getting into the framework we talk about, researcher, is really mapping the expenses that we associate with the retirement plan, which relate to our goals, the four L's, the longevity, core expenses in retirement, lifestyle, the discretionary expenses that give you the best overall standard of living, legacy goals, liquidity for the unexpected spending shocks in retirement. And then just thinking about how are we going to map our assets to these different goals or different liabilities between reliable income, diversified portfolio, and reserve. And so the reliable income is the important one. That's the spending that has some sort of protection behind it. It includes Social Security benefits. For those who have it, it includes a defined benefit pension. But then if there's a gap between the reliable income sources available and the core spending needs in retirement, how do you want to fill the gap? And then that's ultimately what retirement out. If you're a total return investor, you are comfortable filling that gap by drawing from the diversified portfolio. If you have a time segmentation approach, you're going to look more at having short-term buckets of fixed income assets to cover that sort of gap. If you're income protection or risk wrap, you might look at different types of annuity options with lifetime income protections to fill that gap. But having that framework in place to have a strategy that gets you comfortable with funding your core expenses, potentially without market volatility associated with your total returns, can then lay that foundation that your diversified portfolio no longer has to fund essentials, and therefore it can have capacity to be more comfortable with market volatility just because your entire retirement is not dependent on it. You have the ability to maybe make a small cut to the expenditure for more discretionary types of goals to give your portfolio more opportunity to recover and to not be exposed as deeply to that sort of sequence of returns risk about how a market downturn that you have to sell from your portfolio to fund retirement spending can permanently derail that financial portfolio. So having that framework and thinking about how you want to your core retirement expenses, ideally before a market downturn, can help prepare that foundation for you to then, it may be too late for this market downturn, but these downturns are going to happen in the future, and to be better prepared for the next go around in the future, having that framework in place becomes very important.
No, I think that's great. And we went through the trouble of doing that right now because, again, the biases are there. And if you look at, you know, Dan Kahneman, the one, you know, when you really started to write about it and point these out, I mean, the conclusion of him and many others is, look, this is what it is, but this is like gravity. You're not going to ultimately beat it just because knowing it's there. And so, from a psychological standpoint, what matters is the environment in which you have yourself in to give yourself the best chance of success. And if you're working within framework, you're doing two things. You're also beginning to automate the thinking process. You're giving your mind guardrails, effectively, in which to make decisions around. Now, those guardrails, it goes without saying, but this is not always the case of everything you hear. Those guardrails, especially from a retirement income standpoint, need to have some empirical backing. You know, that's the first 12 episodes of this podcast, where it literally just laying that out, frankly. But the reality is you need a framework does wonders in terms of giving you this theoretical backing of guardrails. Now, once you have that in place, you open up yourself to the world of the financial plan. The financial plan is, how do you want to navigate your investment experience and retirement income strategy within this framework, right? Wade just went over the retirement income optimization framework. Are there other potential frameworks that are out there? Absolutely. This is the one that works for us on many levels, and it's the one that empirically we're actually quite happy with the robustness of it, and so we implemented. The RISA was created out of this framework, frankly. Wade gave us the language to create the RISA, if you will. And so to a large extent, the financial plan functions, helps us create, you have your preferences, the financial plan assesses the economic feasibility of this within it. But from a psychological standpoint, it provides the context of why we're investing. It provides the context of how you're navigating through this framework. And that does a couple of things that are interesting and helps us sort of deflect some of these biases. By planning, what you're doing is you're systematically working backwards from an end goal, right? You're saying, where do you want to be? And now let's work backwards to make sure we get there. And that's an interesting concept. And it's, if you read a lot of books that are coming out lately, I'm thinking Annie Duke for one, there's this term called backcasting, right? And this is what this is. You work back going in. You decide what you want to describe as a successful outcome, and you do the things that you systematically need to do to get there, such as your 401k contributions, or if you're in a retirement plan, how you take distributions from a certain asset, or how you're gonna fund some rolling ladder or whatnot. And so, but the idea is that you've already identified the end goal. The end goal can change over time. That's not the issue. But there is an end goal you're working from, and then you refer back from it. Wade, you know what would be interesting? Simply because I know you're a big proponent of, I know you're actively involved in your plan on many levels. How do you think about that from a backcasting perspective, if you don't mind bringing up your own personal situation?
Well, yeah, that's pretty much the idea. You kind of start with the end goal in mind, which is kind of planning to live to 100, and at least being financially prepared to live to 100, having any legacy goal in mind at that point, that this is the terminal wealth still have available at that point, and then making sure that you're implementing a plan that with a conservative rate of return assumption out to get you to that goal. And then when you have financial independence, it means you're at the point where you don't necessarily need to have more inflows of labor income. You now have around that with your conservative return projection and with your spending goals, including for various spending shocks in place, you can take contributions necessary and still have wealth at the end to match that particular goal. So I'll add to that,
Wade never once mentioned the current market environment as playing a role in his plan, nor did you also mention, which maybe it would have been helpful to some, I'm just thinking out loud, Wade is in the risk wrap category, and so he also has some contractual income in place in addition to the market sort of distributions that he could potentially take that adds to the security of any potential volatility into the future. Is that a correct statement on my part, Wade?
Or that I will. I just recently reached my 45th birthday, and most of the time you can't even think about risk wrap strategies before age 45. So getting there.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the idea. And yeah, the only way that current market environment impacts that thinking at all is because markets had been doing so well, that does cause me to want to make sure my plan lower rate of return assumption, just due to this idea that I don't necessarily want to extrapolate high market returns into the future. But now, as markets are coming down, at some point I might feel more comfortable tweaking the return assumption a little higher for subsequent use. But at the same time, you know, I'm falling behind. Like, my financial plan was based on assuming in 2022 I would earn a little bit over a 4% rate of return. It doesn't look like we're going to, at least as of where we are right now, this year. But if I can average that over the long term, then that would get me back on track with the plan.
So there's backcasting. The financial plan, you know, a lot of times a recommendation is a financial plan. And I you know, we say it provides context. But really what it's providing is this backcasting idea. And from a emotional perspective, it helps counter the biases. You know, large, medium, small, results vary based on you, but it helps counter that. The other piece that the financial planning process does is this idea of your future self, right? And this is where you bring up a point called temporal discounting, to sound all fancy. And temporal discounting is our inability, frankly, to see well into the future. How are you going to be? It's one of these things that you tend to act more in the immediacy of things. It's beyond delay gratification. It has nothing to do with that. It's more how you view yourself. And so if you think about it, one of the best sort of, I don't remember who said this, but if you're thinking about doing something now, ask yourself this question. How will you feel about it in 10 minutes, in 10 months, and in 10 years? And I think by just asking the question, the answer becomes obvious in terms of, should I get out of the market because of what's happening right now? You may feel well in 10 minutes, 10 months, maybe, maybe not, 10 years, highly unlikely. Like if it was the eight ball weight, highly unlikely would be my answer. And so if you think about what the financial plan does, it kind of counters this temporal discounting where it's hard to just conceptualize how will you be in 20 years. And so this idea of your future self, it's a term came up with from Hal Hirschfeld, which is, you know, ask yourself how your future self will react to the decision you're making now.
Because what that does is it externalizes your future self. It externalizes Alex Murguia. It externalizes Wade if he's asking that to himself. And it's almost like your future self is saying, hey, what are you doing? And so the financial plan is a great tool to actually do this. You know, it's one of the, you know, a better intervention results when you externalize yourself. You know, take it out of, you know, put yourself out, have an outer body experience, and the financial plan does that to a large extent. Again, something else that counters these biases. Remember, you need a framework, the Rio map, then the financial plan navigates through that framework. But it, by navigating through that framework, it addresses backcasting. It addresses this future self idea and temporal discounting. The other piece, and Wade alluded to it earlier, is that it brings upon a rules-based system for making decisions. It's one of those, you know, you want to remove the emotional component as much as possible from it. Do you want to talk a little bit about this, Wade?
Right. That's this whole idea of like a retirement policy statement or an investment policy statement. If you document the kinds of action you should take in a market downturn, having that documentation available as a reminder, the idea is hopefully that will help you just have the follow the decision making that you created when markets were doing okay, and then knowing that that was more of that rational decision there, so that when markets are down, you're still following that sort of logic that you had created, and you're not allowing the emotions to overcome and control your decision making.
The investment policy statement is like that contract with yourself, right? Or retirement income policy statement. But and even within the financial plan, it does something extra, which is if you did a financial plan that's incorporating scenarios into the mix, well, you can say, hand over your heart, this scenario has effectively been baked into the plan. And even with this scenario in consideration, I am XYZ. I'm able to accomplish it because you've already worked backwards from it. So the financial plan is a living document. It will change, right? Based on your preferences and the like, based on your preferences and goals. Like, I want to do this now instead of that. But the reality is that it's giving you this rules-based decision that has incorporated various good scenarios, poor scenarios, middle-of-the-road scenarios into it. And you've decided on what's that proper balance of success versus failure, but not just success. If it were to fail, how much? What's that magnitude of failure, which is just as an important concept as success. And so what we've reviewed, just to wrap it up here, is, you know, the last episode, it was just about, hey, this is what's happening in the markets from a pure investment standpoint. But the reality is that how we react to it is just as important. So we wanted to take a step back and just point out, listen, as human beings, we've adapted in certain ways for the last 300,000 years that make us the apex creature in this planet, but by the same token, make us maladaptive investors, because the strengths and weaknesses conflict, you know, quite so. That has also led to us having these behavioral biases, which, you know, we need them to survive, but again, conflict with becoming successful investors. Now, knowing them is just not enough, you know, or it's just not enough to change your behavior, because these are just, you know, that sort of nature nurture. There's a lot of nature involved in this. And so to some extent, what we can do is provide ourselves guardrails to give in the decision-making process. Our guardrail is our framework, the retirement income optimization map. And that's, you know, thank Wade for that one, everybody. But that's how we go about navigating through these decisions. Are there other frameworks available? Absolutely. This is the one that works for us. Now, a financial plan within that framework not only provides, you know, works within these guardrails of the framework, but it gives us kind of characteristics that help us counter some of the biases that we have. It gives us backcasting ability, which helps us work from back going, you know, which helps work from a goal, which then provides this strong contextual reason foundation. It provides us to externalize ourselves, which was happening right now with this future version of ourselves, and that counters this temporal discounting. Remember, ask yourself whenever you make these decisions, how will I feel in 10 minutes, 10 months, and 10 years? And just asking that question, I think, provides the answer. And the last part from the financial plan is this rules-based engagement, which you've had multiple scenarios in there in which you've already run these break-even analysis to sort of see what's optimal or what's not. Wait.
Yeah, so to wrap up, there was the old G.I. Joe cartoon in the 1980s that they used to say, and now you know, knowing is half the battle. So being aware of these behavioral issues is half the battle. The other half is just, you know, the continual management and so forth. But hopefully this helps give you that sense of this is all possible. So thanks for listening to Retire with Style, and we'll catch you next time.
Thank you, everyone. Bye.
Looking to build your retirement plan, or just make sure that it still works for you? Speak with a financial advisor from McLean Asset Management. Just go to mcleanam.com/start to get started. That's mcleanam.com/start. Wade and Alex are both principals in McLean Asset Management and retirement researcher. Both are SEC-registered investment advisors located in Tysons, Virginia. The opinions expressed in this program are for general informational and educational purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific securities. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor. All investing comes with a risk, including risk of loss. Past performance does not guarantee future results.